With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, there's only a week left to apply for the California Ag Leadership Program, Class 54. We'll have all the details for you. But our top story today, the latest U.S. drought monitor indicated year-over-year decreases in the amount of drought coverage area for major crops and commodities. Rod Bain has more.
When it comes to areas of agricultural commodities covered by drought, per the April 2nd U.S. Drought Monitor.
If you look at all major crops and commodities, we see pretty much across the board decreases from this time a year ago.
With USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey noting few exceptions, such as soybeans, barley, and sugar beets, seeing year-over-year increases in drought coverage.
Looking at winter wheat, our one very active crop at this time of year, just 18% of the U.S. winter wheat production area currently experiencing drought. That's actually up a little bit from a few weeks ago. We dropped off to 12% during the month of March, but regardless of how you look at it, that is down significantly from 49% of the winter wheat area in drought during the planting season last October.
Reflected in improved winter wheat crop condition ratings over the past 5 weeks. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Questions surround Saskatchewan's potash industry. Dennis Guy reports from Canada.
Saskatchewan is the world's largest producer of commercial potash, with only Russia and Belarus providing competition for world export markets, mining about one-third of easily available potash. This is a major industry and employer for that prairie province, with a large, shallow, high-quality potash seam that is easily accessible for mining. But a former Saskatchewan government cabinet minister, elected member for Regina, and a longtime provincial finance minister has published a book about the province's potash industry. Eric Klein's book, called Squandered, Canada's Potash Legacy, says that the industry is now dominated by what amounts to a cartel. Just two companies, Mosaic and Nutrien, the former Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan. In his book, Klein describes how the industry has grown and how companies ownership is now almost entirely outside of the province.
The growth has been quite dramatic. We were producing about 8 million metric tons in the 1990s. Now we're up to 14 million metric tons. So that's almost a 50% increase. The original companies gradually consolidated into two larger companies, one being Mosaic and the other being the Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan. PCS eventually was privatized to create Nutrien. And the other ones gradually were acquired by Mosaic.
All mineral rights are owned jointly by the province and by the Crown under the Land Titles Act. In his book, Eric Klein says that both governments have lost control of those rights and is no longer receiving its fair share of royalties or taxes from the potash companies.
Very few shareholders reside in Saskatchewan, acquired by large investors outside Saskatchewan, and I think the percentage of ownership in the province is probably something very small, like 1%. And that means that the profits that the companies make go outside the province.
In his book, Squandered, Canada's Potash Legacy, Eric Klein makes the case that the potash industry in Canada is receiving special tax breaks that other industries do not receive. Klein's book attempts to make the case that the provincial auditor needs to take a close look at the companies dominating the potash industry, as he maintains that Saskatchewan is losing millions, perhaps billions of dollars in royalties and revenues.
What we've seen since about 2008, when the world price of potash tripled, is the companies taking more and more money in isn't dependent on investment, it's higher price. When that happened in oil in the 70s, Alberta and Saskatchewan amended the oil leases to take the windfall for the public. In potash, it largely goes to the company. That is grossly imbalanced, in my opinion.
Eric Klein is a former Saskatchewan MP and finance minister and is also a former mining industry executive. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. For today's National Spotlight, here's Cindy Zimmerman.
I'm here at the Ace Fly-In, and I'm with Bill Kauser, my friend from Iowa, who's a cattle producer and an ethanol plant investor, and also a member of the EPA Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Advisory Committee, and something he's been on before and been on for a while. So, Bill, tell us about that committee and your involvement in it.
Yeah, they reenacted it about 6 years ago, and they put out to the United States, they wanted people to put in their application and kind of a broad base across the country of livestock producers and different academia. And out of 560 applications, I was very blessed to be one of the 30 to come on and be able to represent the farming community, the ethanol community, agriculture, basically. And what our job is to do is we basically get three or four challenges every year from the administrator. And our job is to come together with a white paper. Is how can EPA improve their methods of reaching out to rural America, to the cities of America, whether it's wastewater, whether it's manure issues, whether it's methane, and how do we make sure that the administration hears from grassroots?
Well, you've worked with several different EPA administrators. What do you think about our current administrator?
Well, as I stated in the meeting here, we had the privilege of hosting Regan and Vilsack the first week on the job here 3.5 years ago in our shop. And like I stated, it's the first time I've seen in my career of 30 or 40 years coming in here of those two gentlemen from different offices in the same room at the same time, because we would always get their staff. And to see the relationship now that EPA and USDA have and can sit down together, not their staff, but the two leaders, and come to an agreement where everybody can work through some of the issues and policies that we've got going on. And then to be part of the farming community or the agriculture community and bring a recommendation to both of those gentlemen, because, you know, I know them both personally. It means something, and they've always got someone they can call.
Well, you also spend a lot of time here up in D.C. You're here for the ASTC fly-in. You're here almost every year, as far as I know. And you also come up here with other groups. So just tell me about your experience this year and some of the meetings that you had and how they went.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've been doing this for 30 years. And in the last 10 years, we finally have a seat at the table. You know, as a livestock producer, when I put on my cattle cap, you know, the EPA was a bad word. I mean, we would never let them in. And another gentleman, Dave Petty from Iowa, and I decided 20 years ago we were going to change that relationship. So now we've cultivated it to where we have those positions. I have three appointments in EPA now, and we've actually held meetings in the National Cattlemen's Office with EPA, which you would have never heard of 10 years ago. So we feel very strongly that we've cultivated a relationship because they're part of our team now, and we can't forget that. Whether you're ethanol, whether you're agriculture, whatever it is, they're part of your team because it's part of the policy, it's part of the rulemaking. And as a feedlot operator, I have an NPDES permit, so I have rules and regulations I have to follow. And the reason I'm so adamant, I think I'm in here every month for the next 7 months to do something with EPA or USDA, is I want to make sure that my sons, or our sons and daughters, can farm in the future with policy they can survive with.
Well, as far as the issues facing the ethanol industry right now, year-round E15, getting the GREET model right for SAF, those kinds of things, that's what we talked about on the Hill this week. What do you think the chances are that any of that is going to get done in this presidential election year?
Well, I don't know if we'll see it done in this presidential election year. I think everyone, when you go to the Hill, it's a different mindset today. And it's challenging, but we heard positive messages from the D's and from both sides of the aisle. And they all want to get it done. They want to get a farm bill done. They want to get E15. But it's going a little bit slower, I think, on the EPA side because they want to make sure that this is done right and they get sued less. You know, I think that's one of the challenges because everybody's not afraid to sue today. And so if it does take us another year, it might have to be. But we're going to continue to say, let's get it signed because we got to do it eventually. We've smoothed all the rough edges over for whether, you know, on our Hill visits, whether Democrat or Republican. Everybody's in agreement because if you're involved in climate or believe in climate, we're part of the solution. And that's what this administration is driven for. So the big man says, we're doing this. Let's get it done. And I think that's the other thing. I think it's something we need to understand. We will always respect the office of the president, no matter who, because it's our job to decide who's there. And who's ever there, that's fine. But we've learned over the years, we're going to put ourselves close to the career people because they're going to be here the next time I come to D.C.
That's a very good point. That's all the questions I have, Bill. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to thank agriculture for allowing us to be in here, and I want to make sure that everyone, you know, you have the opportunity to come in here and hear your voice.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Kauser here in Washington, D.C. with the Ace Fly-In. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, California's Proposition 12 that restricts in-state sales of products from sows, hens, and calves raised in limited mobility confinement is taking a toll on Midwest producers, according to one senator. Iowa's Chuck Grassley says while Proposition 12 was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court and has only been in effect a few months, its impact on the Midwest pork industry is already evident.
Just to show you the impact on consumers of Proposition 12, pork prices have risen 20% since July of last year, 40% just on pork loins.
That despite an increase in overall pork production last year, and California may not be the last to restrict sales based on livestock confinement methods.
Massachusetts has such a referendum called Question 3. Even Secretary Vilsack has said that without congressional action, these rules will continue to cause chaos in the pork market.
Vilsack criticized the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in favor of Proposition 12 during a Senate ag hearing last month.
I don't think the Supreme Court, when it decided that pork producers had a choice to participate in the California market or not, understood the pork market. When you're dealing with 12% of the pork market in one state, there is not a choice between doing business with in California and not in California.
Vilsack argued someone must provide national consistency and clarity, or 50 different states could have 50 different standards. But Grassley says his GOP-backed EATS Act lacks bipartisan support and has stalled. In other livestock news, the U.S. quota for low-tariff beef imports in Japan was filled by the end of February. Nikkei Asia says that's the fastest rate since 2020. That's not good news for Japan either, as the rest of the year, beef imports are subject to higher tariffs, which means Japan will face challenges to increasing exports of its premium Wagyu beef supplies. The import quota resets yearly on January 1st and has already reached the 65,000 5-ton limit and closed on February 27th. Brazil also shipped beef to the U.S. ahead of the new year. Because of soaring inflation, Brazil aggressively marketed its lower-cost beef. That means Japan and Brazil appear to have used up their tariff quota in the first 2 months of the year, which is 2 months sooner than in 2023. The shared quota has no country or region-specific caps and is effectively a first-come, first-served system, creating intense competition. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
A grower, packer, and shipper of citrus is making electric forklifts work for their operation in the Central Valley. General Manager of Cobblestone Fruit, Colby Campbell, explained their forklift setup.
Rather than have forklifts in one location in the facility, we actually planned ahead and put the chargers, put the forklifts right in the areas where they're working. The idea behind that is for breaks and for lunches, where the employee's working when they're stopped, they go over to the wall, they plug their equipment in, they go to break. Rather than traveling across the facility to one forklift room, which you've traditionally seen in a lot of older facilities, those little pieces capture time, which is money, both for the employee and for the charge of those batteries. And we've tied those into a web-based system that they have, so that we can see when all of the chargers are hooked up. We can also determine the amount of kilowatts going into that. And that allows us to, we feel like, make more educated decisions when it comes to managing both the fleet and the employees.
A survey by AgCareers.com highlights the challenges that U.S. employers face in finding candidates with suitable work-ready skills for the agri-food industry. Problem-solving and decision-making emerged as the top sought-after skill, followed by organization and planning and teamwork. Both current employees and new graduate hires showed significant gaps in problem-solving and decision-making skills. While only 18% of employers found new graduates adequately prepared, 76% said experienced hires possessed these skills. Soft skills training, especially in communication, was deemed crucial for all levels of employees, particularly for new entrants. Industry-specific skills like sustainability and data science were also emphasized. The survey provides detailed insights into skill requirements across different employment levels and agricultural sectors, aiding in addressing workforce skill development needs. The 2023 State of Organic Produce Report from the Organic Produce Network and Category Partners details how the industry did in terms of sales and volume for the previous year. According to the report, U.S. organic produce sales topped $9.6 billion in 2023, marking a 1.6% increase from the year before. Organic produce continued to make up 12% of all retail produce sales, accounting for 7% of total produce volume in 2023. For the second year in a row, organic berries continued to lead the sector in sales, totaling $1.7 billion, increasing 6% from 2022. Sales of organic packaged salads remained strong, coming in at second at $1.5 billion, despite a decline of 5.2% in volume. Bananas continued as the leading category by volume, with 538 million pounds sold in 2023. NRCS California is working with partners to better understand the relationship between ranching activities and western pond turtle populations. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed to list the western pond turtle as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Biologist with Alameda County Conservation District, Farley Connolly, said they're working on tracking the movements of the turtles to get a better picture of how they interact with ranching environments.
Understanding where the turtles are going will allow us to provide that information to ranchers. So these are just all theoretical things they could do, but the idea of them maybe changing their grazing schedule on that property. Turtles nest out of the water between, say, 10 meters and potentially up to a mile away. And so the idea is we want to kind of locate that area, and we may be able to then control, okay, cattle walking over that. Is that a detriment? Is it not? Can we protect the turtles that way and while still, you know, providing good feed for the cows? So it's really trying to establish for them, like, what needs are the turtles have and how can we then work with you to make sure the turtles are happy, but also the cows are happy? Because if this species is listed and they put some really strict regulations on it, we don't want that to happen. We think the turtles and the cows are living in symbiosis right now. They have a very nice relationship. Some of these habitats are really good for turtles and they're being grazed and livestock ponds are being used. So the idea is to make sure we know, like, hey, this system works. We can maybe alter it slightly, but we don't want to just say the cows cannot feed around these ponds within a mile. It's like, that's not what we're going for. Let's prove the system works, pretty much, is what we're kind of looking for.
There's only about a week left to apply for Class 54 of the California Agricultural Leadership Program. The program seeks mid-career individuals in California's agriculture industry, including growers, farmers, ranchers, horticulturalists, and foresters. CALP is considered to be one of the premier leadership development experiences in the United States. The 17-month program offers an intensive curriculum covering leadership theory, effective communication, motivation, critical thinking, emotional intelligence, and more. Participants engage in discussions on social and cultural issues, building critical thinking skills for creative problem solving. California Agricultural Leadership Foundation President and CEO Dwight Ferguson emphasizes the program's focus on selecting fellows committed to California agriculture. Interested candidates are encouraged to apply by April 17th at agleaders.org/class54apply. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Another state confirms bird flu in dairy cattle. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Ohio now has its first case of highly pathogenic avian influenza found in a dairy herd. The state's Department of Agriculture says it is the first case of HPAI in an Ohio livestock operation. The dairy operation received cows from a Texas dairy on March 8th, the same dairy that later reported a confirmed HPAI detection in Texas. Ohio's animal health officials were notified when the livestock began showing clinical signs compatible with the sick lactating dairy cows in other states. USDA, Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, and state veterinary health officials are investigating the emerging illness among the dairy cattle. To date, USDA has confirmed the detection of HPAI in dairy herds in Texas, Kansas, Michigan, New Mexico, Idaho, and now Ohio. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's Chuck Zimmerman.
Kevin, first of all, tell me your name and what you do.
Kevin Johansson, founder of Ag Butler. Ag Butler is a digital marketplace connecting farmers and ranchers with rural labor in our rural communities focused on agriculture.
Well, it's been a while since we've had a chance to talk and kind of like an update because it's been a little while. Sounds like Ag Butler is doing pretty good. So what's new?
Yeah, I think when we last talked, it's been about 3 years. So we've grown exponentially over those last 3 years. We have a little bit under 3,000 users on the platform, and that represents 42 states across the country. Most of our focus is in on the crops and livestock side. And we've been focusing more on connecting laborers with farmers and ranchers. The platform is easy to use. You can sign up and you can get connected with farmers and ranchers in and around your area, but you can also search out for potential laborers that have experience in multiple industries throughout agriculture. And the way we have it set up, it's a user-driven platform to where anybody can see all the data that's run through there. We do not have it algorithm driven like most mainstream job boards.
So I imagine this a lot of this has to do with seasonality, right?
Yes. Starting out, it was set up as a part-time gig work, seasonal work. And when we started talking to more producers and agribusinesses, and they realized we were doing all of our promotion to the rural and ag communities, we started seeing more full-time positions being put on our platform for farm managers, herdsmen, and even agribusinesses in those rural communities looking for key team members to come on and help them thrive in those rural communities.
So tell me how this works. Like if you're, say, a worker looking for work, and is there a fee to use your service?
Right now, it is free to sign up and make a profile, and the only fee is directed to the employer. It's a simple $20 connection fee. As we look to grow this, we're looking to add in more tools that makes it more seamless and more efficient, and look towards more of a membership structure to where there's a lot of in-app communication, and you can pay your labor straight through the platform. We're not taking any percentage of that transaction. We're just there to make a marketplace to make it easier for people to connect.
Can they do this on a computer browser as well as maybe a mobile device?
When we developed the platform, we wanted to make sure we included everybody in agriculture. So we have apps in both the Android and Apple stores, as well as a web-based platform for some of the producers that do not utilize a smartphone.
What do you see at this point looking ahead? I mean, what's like the next step for you?
Like I mentioned before, is adding in those new tools and features to make a membership-based platform, but then also continue to grow and build the platform to where both employers and laborers can add more to their profiles to see what the job entails, but also laborers to promote what they're able to do with certifications, be it herbicide, pesticide application, on the livestock side, people that are BQA or PQA certified. That way, it is upfront that you can see those laborers are definitely qualified, as well as bringing in those new first-generational farmers, but also non-traditional ag students that are looking for more access to more experience and build out their own network. Ultimately, we'd like to get to a platform much like LinkedIn, but for the rural and ag community that is not only connecting labor opportunities, but also continued education and be a digital community.
So when it comes to farmer member organizations, do you collaborate with any of those? It seems like that might be a good thing they could add as a benefit to their members.
And we attribute our connections and partnerships with a lot of those ag groups, organizations, and associations like you mentioned. That's how we've been able to expand our coverage at such a quick rate, working with those groups and providing information to those members on what we can supply them to, decrease that ag labor gap.
How about when it comes to investment? I know you've been doing this for a few years. Do you still seek that kind of assistance to grow and develop?
There's always going to be a need for capital because since we are a app and an online platform, we're always going to have to add more tools and features, keep up with all digital aspects that we need to do. And the biggest thing is promotion and education to our current users and our future users. So yes, we are always looking for additional investment in order to scale and facilitate everything in the country. We're definitely going to look to add more partners in investment to where we can continue to grow and make it more compatible with the evolving ag economy.
Before we close, just anything else that we didn't touch on that you'd want people to know about Ag Butler?
Well, Ag Butler was built with the farmers and ranchers in mind, and not only did we build it for ourselves because we are in ag day-to-day. We run a cattle and hay operation, and other family members run the crop operation in central Missouri. And so we did work with peers in the ag industry to make sure that the platform was compatible with their experience and it was easy to use for producers. And so we always want to work to make ag sustainable. Everybody talks about sustainable practices and protocols, but nobody addresses the real sustainable piece in agriculture, and that's the people. So AgButler wants to be that sustainable piece for people in agriculture.
Well, that is Kevin Johansson. And Kevin, great job that you're doing with AgButler. Thanks for the update. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more Ag News. For today's interview segment, I'm talking with Jacqueline Hurd, the CEO of Elko. All right. Well, I know a little bit about Elko, but for our listeners' sake, tell me a little bit about your company and what you do and who you partner with.
Elko was founded about 6.5 years ago with the idea of bringing innovation to the crop protection sector. So as you know, crop protection is one of the key drivers for improved yield. And globally, there is never been a more critical time in needing to find more sustainable and better ways to improve crop yields to enhance food security. So we set out with the mission to bring innovation that allows us to discover and develop new crop protection chemistry, chemistry that allows us to protect farmers' fields against injurious pests, bring things to the market faster and at a lower cost. And also, the most important thing is bringing products that are not Me Too, that are differentiated and really address some of the key needs that farmers have on their farms.
And so there are a lot of aspects to your company and to what you do, and quite a few things that I want to talk about. And like I said, I'm just really excited to have you here. I want to start out, if we could talk a little bit about what your company is doing to help meet this need of the growing world population. We have heard several times about having to feed so many people by 2050. Let's expand on that a little bit and tell me how Elko is helping.
Well, how we're helping in a very concise, you know, way of describing is that we're really supporting more sustainable and productive food ecosystem. And the way we're doing that specifically is through the discovery of novel small molecule chemistry to protect crops against the devastating effects of pests and disease. And as you know, it's the single biggest lever for improving crop yields is to protecting them against diseases. Because just like humans get sick and so do crops. And so you need to be able to control the diseases that break out on a farmer's field. And so it's something that is so critical to farming. Farmers would definitely agree that it's an absolute requirement and non-negotiable in terms of its need. And we're trying to bring bigger impact to that and try to help improve the sustainability and productivity of food production systems globally.
So just the fact that this is a startup in the ag tech universe, if you will, is pretty big because it's not an easy industry to get into.
Correct.
And the last 6 years, 7 years, last 10 years have not been easy years to start a business at all, much less in agriculture. What are some of the things, that challenges that you have overcome and really, you know, gotten through to get to this point?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting time for agriculture, but I think there's an awareness of its criticality. I think one of the things that we've addressed is really when you think about small startups in the agriculture space, often there's a long development cycle from the time that you start to bring your innovation, you know, discover the innovation and then bring it to the market. And so one of the ways in which we have overcome that challenge of just a long development cycle is by, first of all, you know, having a great story that describes the impact that we're going to have as a bigger company. So we were able to raise a large amount of capital. In the last little over a year, we raised $80 million for our Series C. And so I think we've had the capital to bring, you know, our innovation forward. But even with that amount of capital, you have to address the timelines to bring things to the market. And so the way in which we've addressed that timeline is really by having a very collaborative business model. So we work with the big multinationals in the space trying to help bring innovation and products into their pipeline that are differentiated. And so we've had several partnerships announced, including with Bayer and Syngenta. We work with Nufarm and also the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on these innovations. And so I think that more collaborative business model that allows us to monetize some of our asset at various stages during their development process allows us to generate revenue at the same time as we're bringing forward products all the way, you know, to commercialization and to the market.
And then all of this is huge on its own. I want to make a point of that, that all of this is significant just from the business aspect, from the agriculture aspect, but also we just had National Women in Ag Day, which was March 24th. And in other industries, we see a lot of women CEOs and we see more women leaders, but still agriculture hasn't reached that point yet. And so you are a role model and really as a female leader in this male-dominated industry. And can we talk about that a little bit and what that means to you?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, one of the things that has been true about me in my career is I decided very early on that I was going to work in the agriculture space. And so I'm a scientist by training. And after, you know, getting a PhD, I went and to a small startup because I felt I was just sort of very entrepreneurial. I always say that I think being an entrepreneur is a personality trait. And then it's what skills do you bring to the table to enable you to be more entrepreneurial? And so I was a scientist. And then through working at a startup and then moving into a big multinational where I worked for 12 and a half years, I really honed those skills and brought a business aspect. So the scientific background, but then the business aspect. So I think being completely focused and dedicated, every career move I've made in my life has been toward bringing innovation to the agriculture sector. So I've been very true to what I saw as my mission from the get-go. And then have used being entrepreneurial as a means to, you know, take calculated risks, but also then honing in on my skills in business, which has actually allowed things to really open up for me in terms of leading organizations to bring this innovation forward. And I have to say it's incredibly rewarding, very fun. I love building organizations and having that focus has been excellent. And it's a really, really fun job. What I do.
More than likely that you enjoy it so much also helps, I think, with success as well. At least I find that to be true in my career too.
Oh, absolutely. I hope it's essential. Yeah, because you need to spend a lot of time doing it.
True. And also, you know, I'm a huge believer in mentorship, and I know that you are very involved in other female-driven communities. What things do you do and how are you helping to empower other women in ag and ag tech?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that everything from how I mentored people when I was leading R&D organizations at multinationals, but also just in the support of, you know, women in agribusiness. I love to engage with women entrepreneurs. And when I was doing venture capital, you know, I also really engaged and loved helping women entrepreneurs be more successful, you know, in their efforts.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now we continue our conversation with Jacqueline Hurd of Elko Inc. If I can put you on the spot for a minute here, I'm going to put you into a situation that I faced. It was last November and I was moderating a discussion on women in agriculture, but in farm broadcasting, which is what I do. And the first question I had during our session was from a man who came in and asked, why do women need to have a session like this? Why are you even having this session? If I were to ask you, why you know, why support women specifically in these roles, what would you say?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, it's not unlike growth of in a sector. So for instance, when you think about agriculture in general, you probably have realized that even when you think about venture capital coming to the ag sector, when I started at my first startup, there was no venture ecosystem in agriculture at all. So then you saw the entrance of large capital. It was sometime after, you know, Monsanto bought Climate Corporation for close to $1 billion. And that was something that sort of, I think, catalyzed increased investment in the sector. When you saw that, it took a while for there to be growth and maturation and the quality of the entrepreneurs that were coming, that were investable in the space. And so I feel like with women too, with the being a somewhat of a male dominated industry, that it is, we're just sort of in that growth phase and that maturation. And I'm quite confident that women more and more will want to take on the challenges in the agriculture space. So I feel like there's a little bit of a lag in the maturation of women as founders and entrepreneurs coming forward. And so just like it was so important for big companies and different venture capital firms to really support innovation in the sector with financing and with their roles and boards of growing the entrepreneurs in this space to be better and better, the same thing needs to happen for women. So I think that it's critically important to provide that support, to provide mentorship. And then, you know, more and more, I think women will see successes and that will breed additional success and support for women going forward. I just think it's a wonderful place to encourage women to have an impact in and to be passionate about. And so I think it is a reflection of just the immaturity, but yet the growth of innovation and startups in this sector.
Yeah, kind of along that line, but speaking as a whole now, as we look at the future of ag innovation, what would you say to anybody up and coming now, the younger generation that is looking at this and saying, yes, I think maybe that's what I want to get into? What advice would you give to them?
I would give them the advice of trying to take as many opportunities to broaden your experience base. So, you know, I started a startup. I went to a huge multinational. I learned in each change in my career, while it was all always very focused on crop agriculture, each of those opportunities, I learned so much about what it takes to bring innovation to the market. So I would just say embrace challenges. If you have opportunities to make career moves where you can actually learn something else that makes you a better entrepreneur, to do it. Because I think those experiences, whether it was going to get my MBA or doing venture capital or working in a huge multinational leading large R&D, each of those experiences has been very formative and helping me be more well-rounded in terms of being a successful CEO in this space and founder.
So those are all the questions that I had for you, but I wonder if there's any final thoughts or anything else that you would like for our listeners to know, either about you or about your business or thoughts for the future.
I think just, no, I mean, I think thank you very much for your interest in ENCO and your interest in women in agriculture. I think it's such an important time to bring innovation into this space and to supporting all types of entrepreneurship and diversity of thinking and thought is critical. So thanks for bringing additional awareness to the space.
Thank you once again to Jacqueline Hurd. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.